Good morning. Good to see everyone. We're continuing in the Kings and the Prophets, and there's parallel sections. As you go through 1st and 2nd Samuel, and 1st and 2nd Kings, there's parallel sections in 1st and 2nd Chronicles. So as you've probably noticed if you've been here, and if you're familiar with it, it's like there's two different versions sometimes. A lot of times it's quite similar. It's a little bit like reading perhaps the Gospel of Matthew and then the Gospel of Luke. You'll have the same story told in different places. So we have this morning, in 2 Kings chapter 12, we read about Joash, King Joash. And we also read about King Joash in 2 Chronicles 24. So those are our passages this morning. So I'm probably going to spend most of my time reading through the 2 Chronicles 24 passage, but I'd like to mention the first verse of 2 Kings chapter 12, and you can read along if you have a Bible. 2 Kings chapter 12 verse 1 says, "In the seventh year of Jehu, Joash became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 40 years. His mother's name was Zibiah. She was from Beersheba. Joash did what was right in the eyes of the Lord all the years Jehoiada the priest instructed him." And if you were here last week, you learned a little bit about how Joash got his start. It's a very dramatic story, amazing story. Jehoiada played a key role, the priest, and Joash became king at the age of 7 years old. As Paul was saying, we hear a lot about the kings, some were better than others, but they all fall short. And especially in the northern kingdom of Israel, essentially they were all bad. Even the good ones in Judah were a lot of the times only partly good. And they had a good start and then they ended up kind of bad. Or they were mostly bad and then maybe sort of turned around for the good at the end of their life. Not very good. It's a little bit, well, they all fall short just like each of us. But it's interesting, Frank said last Sunday, God's will prevails. And in spite of bad kings, bad people of Judah or Israel, God's will prevails. We could say that this morning too. Or we could say that for a lot of the passage, God's will prevails in spite of men, kings, people falling short. But I'm going to look at a different end of the story today. And join me, if you can, in 2 Chronicles chapter 24. I'm going to read through some of that. And we trust that God will bless his word this morning. And so 2 Chronicles 24 starts off a fair bit the same as the 2 Kings, talking about Joash. Joash did what was right in the eyes of the Lord all the years of Jehoiada the priest. Jehoiada chose two wives for him, and he had sons and daughters. And maybe that's a good thing that Jehoiada chose two wives, even though we object to more than one wife, don't we? But in a way, judging from the other kings and how many wives they had, and the quality, perhaps, of their wives, you don't have to look too far back. Joash's grandmother, Athaliah, not too good. Or I guess it was his great-grandmother, Jezebel, not too good. So in spite of the fact that we're talking about two wives when we're supposed to have one, at least Jehoiada had some input, and maybe some positive input in terms of wives. It makes a big difference who you marry. And limited it to two. It should only be one, but at least he's limiting the damage that can be done. And so that was probably some relatively good input from Jehoiada. Sometime later, in verse 4, Joash decided to restore the temple of God. Sounds pretty good. He called together the priests and Levites and said to them, "Go to the towns of Judah and collect the money due annual from all Israel to repair the temple of your God. Do it now." Good job, Joash, I think. But the Levites did not act at once. Therefore, verse 6, the king summoned Jehoiada the priest, chief priest, and said to him, "Why haven't you required the Levites to bring in from Judah and Jerusalem the tax imposed by Moses, the servant of the Lord, and by the assembly of Israel, the tent of the testimony?" Now the sons of that wicked woman, Athaliah, had broken into the temple of God and had used even its sacred objects for the Baals. At the king's command, a chest was made and placed outside at the gate of the temple of the Lord. A proclamation was then issued in Judah and Jerusalem that they should bring to the Lord the tax that Moses, the servant of God, had required of Israel in the desert. All the officials and all the people brought their contributions gladly, dropping them in the chest until it was full. Sounds good. Whenever the chest was brought in by the Levites to the king's officials, and they saw that there was a large amount of money, the royal secretary and the officer of the chief priest would come and empty the chest and carry it back to its place. He collected a great amount of money. They hired masons and carpenters to restore the Lord's temple, and also workers in iron and bronze. Verse 13, the men in charge of the work were diligent. Sounds good. And the repairs progressed under them. They rebuilt the temple of God according to its original design and reinforced it. When they had finished, they brought the rest of the money, the king and Jehoiada, and with it were made articles for the Lord's temple. Money left over. And they were being honest with the money, not misusing it. Sounds good. As long as Jehoiada lived, burnt offerings were presented continually in the temple of the Lord. Good stuff. Sounds good, doesn't it? Now, Jehoiada, in verse 15, was old and full of years, and he died at the age of 130. He was buried with the kings in the city of David because of the good he had done in Israel for God and his temple. So thumbs up to Jehoiada. Good things are happening. But in verse 17, after the death of Jehoiada, the officials of Judah came and paid homage to the king, and he listened. They abandoned the temple of the Lord, the God of their fathers, and worshipped Asherah poles and idols. Sounds like Joash shouldn't have listened to them, but he did. Because of their guilt, God's anger came upon Judah and Jerusalem. And we're not left guessing as to what God thought about this. Quite obvious, God's anger came upon Judah and Jerusalem. Although the Lord sent prophets to the people to bring them back to him, and though they testified against them, they would not listen. Listening's important, isn't it? Joash listened to the wrong people. And along with the other people, they didn't listen to the prophets whom they should have listened to. Then the Spirit of God, in verse 20, came upon Zechariah, son of Jehoiada, the priest. He stood before the people and said, "This is what God says. Why do you disobey the Lord's commands? You will not prosper. Because you have forsaken the Lord, he has forsaken you." But they plotted against him, and by order of the king, they stoned him to death in the courtyard of the Lord's temple. King Joash did not remember the kindness Zechariah's father Jehoiada had shown him, but killed his son, who said as he lay dying, "May the Lord see this and call you to account." And it's a downward slide very quickly, not only to abandoning God and worship of God, worshipping idols, to now stoning the messenger, killing the messenger, the prophet, a priest who spoke as a prophet. So not just any priest, he was a priest that says very clearly, spoke by the Spirit of God prophetically. Not only that, this was Zechariah the son of Jehoiada. So it was Joash's loyalty should have been to Jehoiada and to Jehoiada's son Zechariah. How much did Joash owe Jehoiada? His very life. If you remember back in the last story, the only reason Joash was alive is because he was protected by Jehoiada, and it would have been his aunt, actually, Jehosheba. So he owed his life to Jehoiada. His grandmother would have killed him, like she killed all his brothers. He was the youngest one, the only one left. He owed Jehoiada his undying loyalty. But when his son comes along, Zechariah, and says something he doesn't like. Amazing. It's very sad. Killed. And so, Zechariah's last words, "May the Lord see this and call you to account." Indeed, in verse 23, at the turn of the year, the army of Aram marched against Joash. It invaded Judah and Jerusalem and killed all the leaders of the people. The leaders of the people, who were they? It's the same word in Hebrew, leaders, the people. Leaders. As it is in verse 17, officials of Judah. Could be the same people, the first ones to pay for them going astray. Killed all the leaders of the people. They sent all the plunder to their king in Damascus. Although the Aramean army in verse 24 had come with only a few men, the Lord delivered into their hands a much larger army. And that's how it works, doesn't it? Just like Moses had predicted long ago in Deuteronomy when he said to Israel, if you follow the Lord, it's only going to take one of you in battle against 10 or 10 against 1,000. But if you don't follow the Lord, it's going to be the other way around. It's going to be 10 of them that's going to rout 1,000 Israelites. And that's what happened here. Exactly the same. It's tempting to have strength in numbers. And I'm sure Joash saw the size of his army and thought, we're fine. These guys, they're great. It's probably tempting to have confidence in numbers for us today as well. There's a lot of people on our side. Feel pretty good. Feel pretty comfortable. It's more important to be on the Lord's side, isn't it? Because Judah had forsaken the Lord, the end of verse 24, the God of their fathers, judgment was executed on Joash. So once again, we're not left to guess. It says it in black and white. Because Judah had forsaken the Lord, the God of their fathers, judgment was executed on Joash. Just like Zechariah said, because you have forsaken the Lord, he has forsaken you. And so because Judah had forsaken the Lord, the God of their fathers, judgment was executed on Joash. When the Arameans withdrew in verse 25, they left Joash severely wounded. His officials conspired against him for murdering the son of Jehoiada, the priest, and they killed him in his bed. So he died and was buried in the city of David, but not in the tombs of the kings. So once again, not honored in his death, the same way Jehoiada was. Those who conspired against him in verse 26 were Zabad, son of Shimeath, an Ammonite woman, and Jehozabad, son of Shimrith, a Moabite woman. The account of his sons, the many prophecies about him, and the record of the restoration of the temple of God are written in the annotations on the book of the Kings, and Amaziah, his son, succeeded him as king. So a story that starts off good, starts off positive, encouraging, good things are happening, ends up ending in discouragement, ends up ending. It's kind of a sad story. It's very sad. It's a little bit depressing. And a lot of these stories are. A lot of the stories of the kings, bad kings. Seems like they should know better. I grew up sort of listening to these stories, Bible stories, not just the kings, but people in the book of Judges, the Israelites, falling into idolatry. Sometimes it doesn't seem like it was so much falling. It seems like they actually wanted to worship idols. Then they go into slavery, subjugation from other nations, and then they cry out to the Lord, and the Lord sends someone to help, and they do better. They start worshiping the Lord. Then the cycle begins again. We all fall short. All the kings fall short, as Paul said this morning, and it's true. We all fall short. Well, I think the interesting thing from this story is that the role that someone like Jehoiada plays in the life of Joash is very important. It's interesting. Turns out, I think the main idea is that guidance matters. As it said in the 2 Kings 12, verse 2, Joash did what was right in the eyes of the Lord all the years Jehoiada the priest instructed him. Jehoiada instructed him. Instruction, guidance, mentorship. Guidance matters. We can learn from that this morning. It's true for us today. We need more people like Jehoiada, don't we? We need someone that provides guidance, someone that provides instruction to people that need it. We need mentors, good mentors like Jehoiada. Guidance matters. What makes a good mentor? What makes a good guide? What makes a good leader? I think there's three things. At least a couple of them come from our passage today. What makes a good mentor? Number one, initiative. And this is probably shown by Jehoiada in previous passages in the story from last week. Jehoiada had to take the initiative to make sure Joash was made king. This is just a little boy, perhaps an infant, when they discovered that Athaliah was killing everybody else. So, as it says in 2 Chronicles 23, verse 1, in the seventh year, Jehoiada showed his strength. He made a covenant with the commanders, and he made it happen. He took initiative. It wasn't going to happen by itself. Chapter 24, verse 3, Jehoiada chose wives for Joash. He took initiative. A good mentor takes initiative, takes the lead, takes steps, because guiding doesn't happen by accident. It's a little bit like Jehoiada was basically the closest thing Joash had to a dad. He lost his dad, and Jehoiada basically was his father. maybe some parents today. I think of myself as a parent, and as I was a kid raised, parents, in a sense, should be mentors for their children. Parents should be guides. They should instruct their children. Does the Bible teach that parents instruct their children? Does the Bible teach that parents train their children? It's an example of what's involved in mentorship. It's like parenting. And those that are parenting think of themselves as mentors. They have to take the initiative. A kid isn't going to find the right way on their own. Children, like everybody else, naturally fall into sin. They need to be trained. They need to be set in the right direction. The idea of instruction, I looked up the Hebrew word. The Hebrew word is more used sometimes literally in terms of shooting arrows, or it's used in the direction of a stream, and then it's figuratively used as instruction, training, teaching. And so we instruct in a certain direction. It's true for parents. It's not going to happen by itself. If you want your kids to do what they're supposed to, sometimes you actually have to make them. I know it was true for me growing up. I had to be made to do it. And once the kids actually start doing it, even if they don't want to do the right thing, they may be forced into the habit of doing the right thing. And once the habit is formed, then it's easy for them to do the right thing without having to be made to do it. But initially, if I'm doing chores around the house, I'm not going to do it unless I, at whatever age, 4, 5, 6, 7, am made to do it. So that's part of taking initiative. How do kids in different cultures and places around the world get used to eating foods perhaps that we're not used to eating, spicy foods? That's what they get, and that's what they have to eat. If we're not used to spicy food, they get used to it because that's what they got to eat. And so they get used to it, and then they do it. They're made to do it. I think of taking the initiative there. I got my eyes fixed because I wanted to not wear glasses or contacts. It's a little bit weird getting your eyes fixed laser surgery when you're getting old. I don't think of myself as old, but they told me, oh, you're getting old. If you're in your 40s, you're pretty soon going to have to, you're going to have reading glasses if you get your eyes. Your eyes are going to be better for distance when you get older, not so much for forward because your eyes don't work. I said, fix my eyes so that they can both see distance because that's what I need. Distance vision. And they said, okay. And then when I got into the operating room with the laser surgery, the guy that was the doctor, the guy that was doing said it, I'm going to do your right eye for distance and I'm going to do your left for just a little bit closer. It's not what I asked for. He said, I'm just kind of going to split the difference with your left eye and do it just kind of not quite as good distance viewing so that you use it for reading a little better. It's not what I asked for, but he took the initiative to take a step forward in an initiative and say, this is what I'm going to do. And I said, turned out pretty good, actually, because now my left eye is pretty good for reading. My right eye is not so good. I have to go like this. So when I'm reading like this, I kind of go like this. I get in the habit of using my left eye. This guy took the initiative. If he had merely done what I wanted, I may not have ended up quite as well off. And so even at our old age, sometimes we need someone to take the initiative and tell us something we don't want to hear. What makes a good mentor? Taking the initiative. What makes a good mentor? Also, discipleship. As we read in chapter 23, verse 16, Jehoiada made a covenant that he and the people and the king would be the Lord's people. So as believers in the Lord Christ, sometimes we think this should go without saying that a mentor should follow the Lord. Like Jehoiada made a covenant that he and the people and the king would be the Lord's people, not Baal's people, not Asherah's people, the Lord's people. And so a good mentor follows the Lord. A good mentor cares about discipleship in the right direction, following the Lord. It doesn't go without saying, we follow Jesus. And so a good mentor takes initiative. A good mentorship takes discipleship seriously. Number three, what makes a good mentor? Duplication. And unfortunately, apart from Jehoiada's son Zechariah, we don't see his good judgment duplicated in Joash, even though Joash was his protege. Joash was his mentee. He did the right thing, but he didn't manage, for whatever reason, whether it was his fault or Joash's fault, to instill this in Joash, so that Joash, in turn, did the same things that Jehoiada did without having to be told all the time. And so a good mentor duplicates himself. Number one, initiative. Number two, discipleship. Number three, duplication. So we have to look elsewhere for a good example of duplication. It's like Paul said to Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 2. Paul was a mentor to Timothy, wasn't he? Paul was a good mentor. He says in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 2 to Timothy, he says, "The things you have heard me say in the presence of many witnesses, entrust to reliable men who will also be qualified to teach others." And so Paul, here's a good example of mentorship. Paul says to Timothy, entrust these things to reliable men. So Paul teaches Timothy, and Timothy teaches other men who will also be qualified to teach the others. Paul teaches Timothy, Tim teaches others, and the others should go on to teach others. So a good mentor duplicates himself. A good mentor teaches the teachers to teach. A good mentor takes initiative. A good mentor is involved in discipleship. And a good mentor duplicates himself. We see that in the life of Christ. In Luke chapter 9, verse 2, we have the example of Christ being a mentor, duplicating himself in terms of his ministry. Luke chapter 9, verse 2, Jesus sent the 12 out to preach the kingdom of God and to heal the sick. That's what Jesus was doing. And he sent his 12 disciples out to do the same thing. Duplication. In chapter 10, verse 9, he sends the 72, doesn't he? Heal the sick. Tell them the kingdom of God is near you. Duplication. A good mentor takes initiative. A good mentor does discipleship. A good mentor duplicates himself. I think even of our experience, some of you remember our brother Stan King, who was involved here for many years at Bethel. And I know that he understood the idea of duplication. I know that he knew that in spite of all the ministry that he did, all the good things that he did, he needed to duplicate himself in leaders that would come after him. So he took, for example, someone that we're familiar with, George Idema, and spent time with him, discipled him, taught him. And now George Idema here, has been an elder at Bethel for many years. And so examples right here among us. Imperfect as they may be, duplication. What makes a good mentor? Initiative, discipleship, duplication. And what makes a good mentee? It takes two to tango. It's teamwork. At some point, eventually, the apprentice has to be willing to follow. We need a follower. We need a disciple. So what makes a good mentee? It turns out some of the same things. Initiative. Sometimes you have to seek out a mentor. Each of us probably is a mentee before we become a mentor. Each of us is an apprentice before we teach other people. So we have to seek out a mentor. And of course, it should go without saying, but it doesn't perhaps, that Jesus is the ultimate mentor, isn't he? Jesus is the ultimate one to follow. We want to be a disciple of Jesus. We follow Jesus. Jesus is the Son of God. Jesus loved himself and gave himself for us. We believe in Jesus to be saved, forgiven. We're his disciples. Jesus is the ultimate mentor. On Christ, the solid rock I stand. All other ground is sinking sand, we sang this morning. Nicodemus apparently expended a little effort seeking out Jesus. He came to Jesus by night to ask him some important questions. Sometimes you have to take the initiative to seek out a mentor. Zacchaeus, he was short, so he climbed a tree so that he could see Jesus. He took the initiative, didn't he? He put some effort into seeing Jesus. And he ended up being able to spend some time with Jesus as a result. It's important to seek out the right mentor, not the wrong mentor. And so Joash is an example of a bad mentee, isn't he? He disregarded Jehoiada's instruction. He ignored the prophets that came later, but he listened to the wrong people. Seek out the right mentor, someone that is a disciple of Christ. A good mentee takes the initiative, and the good mentee, as it turns out, cares about discipleship. And that means if you're the apprentice, that means that you submit to your trainer, as hard as that may be at times. It means that you follow your mentor. And once again, the Apostle Paul's an example. 1 Corinthians 11 verse 1 says, Paul is talking to the Corinthians, and he says, follow my example as I follow the example of Christ. You've got to follow the guide, the leader. And so even human leaders can be used as mentors. It's a key verse. Paul says, follow my example as I follow Christ. So your mentor has to follow Christ to qualify to be followed. I remember I spent some time as an apprentice. Some of you remember Martin Siemens used to come here, Martin and Rosemary. He was a drywall taper, and he was willing to take me on as an apprentice. And so he knew what he was doing, tape drywall, and to make a beautiful wall that someone could paint, and then it would end up flat and smooth. It's not as easy as it looks. It's a bit of a hard trade to fake. But he was my mentor, and he'd teach me a few things. I had to be willing to learn. I had to submit to his training. And I'd take a 4-inch putty knife to maybe coat some screws. And he said to me, don't hold it like a club. Hold it like this or like this. And so I'd try and learn how to hold it properly, to coat the screws properly. And he'd see something I do that wasn't quite right, wasn't quite coated right. And he'd say, be more like me and less like you. It was hard to take, but I had to try and interpret that and try and figure out what he was trying to tell me. I had to try and be, it was true, more like him. And of course, I have a suspicion that he said that to me because that's what the person that taught him to tape told him. I'm just guessing, but there's a good chance that that was the same thing that was told to him. And so a mentor has to be committed to discipleship. We got to submit to our mentor. Our mentee has to submit to the mentor. So the things that make a good mentee, apprentice, follower, are a lot of the same things that make a good mentor. Initiative, discipleship, and also duplication, because we have to duplicate what our mentor does. And it has to continue. So we have to do what they do, and then eventually we have to be in a position to teach others. It's interesting to use the example of Paul the Apostle again when he's speaking to not just Timothy, but another apprentice of his, Titus. In chapter 2, he tells Titus to teach what is in accord with sound doctrine. And it's not only the church leaders that end up teaching. It's everybody that's in a position to teach others, to train and to guide. It may be only men that stand up here and preach, but it's the best person to teach a younger woman as an older woman, as Paul says to Titus, for example. Teach the older women to be reverent in the way they live, not to be slanderers or addicted to much wine, but to teach what is good. So those that learn, in turn, teach. Then they can train the younger women to love their husbands and children, and so on. And so women can teachers too. So a good mentee takes the initiative as well. A good mentee is involved in discipleship and duplication. And so guidance matters, makes a big difference. We need a good guide. We need people that are willing to be taught, people that have an open mind, people that follow the right advice and the right instruction. That's what I'd like to leave you with today. It's true today as much as ever. Seems like today we need it. In the words of Hosea, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. It's true. And I think Western society is quite a bit like Joash. Western society had a good start, a good foundation of leaders and instruction in the Word of God, a Judeo-Christian heritage in Western society. And like Joash, it seems like the people have abandoned it. It's the old man, 130 years old. Don't have to listen to him anymore. Let's hear what the young leaders have to say. Downward spiral in Western society. Couldn't help but agreeing with what Paul said. Our Canadian culture is quickly becoming a mission field itself. Not even so much the foreigners that are here, but the natives, people that have been here for generations, have no idea the truths of God. And so Hosea says a people without understanding will come to ruin. And that's what we're up against. So guidance matters. Join me in participating as a mentor and as an apprentice for the kingdom. Let's close in a word of prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you for your word and the solemn reminder of people like Joash. And a sad story as it turns out, but we have the opportunity to learn from it. And we thank you that so many of these stories even though the outcome was difficult, that God ultimately prevails. And we can take the example of Jehoiada, and we ask that we would be strong in your word, that we would have godly influence, that we would submit to godly leaders, that we would submit to your word and to Christ. And if anyone's here that hasn't submitted to Christ for salvation, that they would be convicted by your Holy Spirit to do so. We ask that you would encourage each of us to submit to your word, to take instruction, and to learn and to pass it on. So be with us today, and as we go from here, we ask in Christ's name.